I want to head back into the odysseys of Abraham and Sarah. We've been working through Genesis, and I want to step back into the adventures that they're having. And as we do that, the next few chapters of Genesis are a crazy collection of stories that, honestly, they feel like they belong more in a Game of Thrones script than they do in Scripture. The oddities of these chapters are like looking at a confusingly thick jungle canopy. It's hard to know, what exactly am I looking at? What exactly should I even be trying to look for in these stories? Because it's all very foreign and exotic to our ears, and it's, I think, very easy to get lost in details that sort of offend our particular cultural sensibilities. So I want to sort of encourage us as we start here to allow the peculiarities of these next few chapters to feel a little bit Hollywood to you. Because they are. They're a little Hollywood, a little dramatic. And so allow for that, but what we're going to try to do is peek under the thick narrative canopy, and what I hope we can do together is find some patterns packaged in these stories. Because I think that those patterns reveal something, actually, that's very important about faith and life and God and our part in that journey. And so I want to take you through these wild and dramatic chapters to begin. And so hold on, because it gets weird quick. And hopefully, once I move us through those, we can sort of unpack some things. But the adventure begins for Abraham and Sarah. Abraham and Lot's cattle workers, they start feuding with one another. They've been traveling together, and there's just not enough pastures for the two of them. So they start feuding. So Abraham and Lot, they decide, let's split up. And Abraham says to Lot, you pick where you want to go. So Lot picks the direction he wants to go with his cattle, and Abraham goes the opposite direction. So the adventure begins. The two of them have split company. And then after that sequence in Genesis 14, we're suddenly thrust into this major adventure. It sort of comes out of nowhere. And it just seems to come sort of dramatically to us, but we're immediately thrust into area tribal tensions. And it culminates in this fascinating battle scene. And from what we know of the chapter, out of Mesopotamia, you can see here, come these warring parties. There's an allegiance of four kings. And they're going to look to raid a certain area. They're looking to gain riches in the form of cattle and slaves. And so their plan is to swoop into the area, to the land just south of the Dead Sea. And their hope is, we can defeat the people there, we'll carry off some goods, some riches, some people, and we'll take it back with us. And so that's not good if you live in the area, right? Word gets around, a warring party is coming towards us. And so a local alliance of five kings form, and they decide, we're going to ride out and do battle with these four Mesopotamian kings. And at this point, Abraham's playing Switzerland. He doesn't want to get involved. He's neutral, so he's staying out of the problems here. And so the story of the battle unfolds this way. The four kings of Mesopotamia come in, and they completely rout the five kings. And it's clear in battle that the five kings have lost, and so they look to make a retreat. But as they retreat, after having lost, they get stuck in tar pits. So they get stuck, and they can't get away. And interestingly enough, those pits are apparently still around today, and apparently they have bitumen reserves. I don't even know what that is, but they're there. And so you can see in this next photo here, that's what it looks like from the air, and there's a sign there, beware of the sinkholes ahead. So they get stuck in there, and that's not good. And so the five kings are retreating, some are stuck, we're told others fled to the hills to hide. And what this means is that the cities of the five kings are now completely vacant and open to being looted. And so the four kings ride into their cities, they steal their wealth, they steal their flocks, they steal their people, and they start heading home. And apparently poor Lot has pitched his tent just outside of Sodom and Gomorrah, two of the kingdoms there. And he and his family get swept up. So he's been taken captive along with his wealth, his family. They've been taken captive and they're being headed back to Mesopotamia. Now, Abraham gets word that his nephew Lot has been stolen, and a weird detail emerges. It's bizarre, these things. Apparently, Abraham has an elite fighting force of like 318 men just sitting in reserve. And so he's got this Navy SEAL squad, apparently. And it sort of like feels like the 300 from Sparta, right? Like, I don't know if they're that ripped, but whatever. Little eye candy for us this morning there. And so he decides he's going to go on a rescue mission. And he takes this group of 318 men, and apparently they're incredibly talented. So he takes them, and at night they divide into two camps, and he goes and he rescues Lot. He defeats the five kings. He steals back all that the five kings had stolen. So he's a hero in the area. He's rescued everything that's been stolen, and he's heading home on his way. And then another bizarre thing just shows up. To start, some mysterious king that we've never heard of before at this point in the story rides out to meet and bless Abraham. And notice what he brings with him. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abraham, saying, "Blessed be Abraham, God by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Melchizedek. This is a portrait of Reuben's interpretation of Abraham and Melchizedek meeting. So we've got this mysterious king, and it's bizarre. He's not mentioned again in Genesis. He shows up 1,000 years later in the book of Psalms, and then he features prominently in the book of Hebrews. Some reason he features prominently there. And we're told that Jesus is referenced as a priest in the order of Melchizedek. It's weird. It's got like these hyperlinked scripture things. And it's bizarre because in the Protestant tradition, this has led to sort of two trains of thought. One thought is Melchizedek is like an archetype of Jesus thousands of years before Jesus. I mean, bread and wine, priest of the Most High God, like, But there's another train of thought that thinks this is what we call a Christophany, that Jesus actually shows up earlier in history. And so my friend Riley likes to call this time-traveling Jesus. He sort of shows up in history here, and it's like this bizarre detail, and it's speculative, so I don't want to get too far down that track. But so that happens. And then this happens. Abraham, suddenly, he has, he meets the king of Sodom. I almost forgot about that. So he's coming back with all the spoils of war, and the five kings come out of hiding, and they're like, sweet, maybe we can get some of our stuff back. So the king of Sodom said to Abraham, listen, just give me the people and keep the goods for yourself. But Abraham said to the king of Sodom, with raised hand I have sworn an oath to the Lord, God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or the strap of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say I made Abram rich. I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belonged to the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them have their share. This is particularly interesting to me after last week, because remember what happens. Abraham heads down to Egypt, plays the coward, and profits from it. And now he's maturing in his life. He's growing, developing, and in this case, he plays the very brave one, the courageous one, and refuses to profit from it. His prophet is doing the right thing, and so it's lovely. You start to see this growth in Abraham, but it's not going to be a straight line up, that's for sure. And then after that, a bizarre sequence happens. Abraham has two transcendent encounters with God. God comes and speaks to Abraham, and Abraham starts to complain. He says, hey, God, do you remember how you promised me 10 years ago you would give me a child and I would be the father of nations and bless everyone? Hey, remember that? Yeah, well, it hasn't happened. And I'm not getting any younger. I'm 85 at this point. So what's the deal? And the Lord talks back and says, you will have a child. It's going to happen. Now make a sacrifice. Abraham does. It's bizarre. Takes a heifer, a goat, a ram, a dove, and a pigeon, kills them, cuts them in half, separates them. Boom. He's made his sacrifice. But then something really, really odd happens. As the sun was setting, we're told, Abraham fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. You don't hear that talked a lot about, visions of God that put you into a place of deep darkness. And notice what the Lord says to him. Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own. They'll be enslaved and mistreated there, but I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace, be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And when the sun had set and darkness had fallen, a smoking fire pot with a blazing torch appeared and passed between the pieces of the sacrifice. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. This is very strange. Very strange. Abraham falls into some sort of revelatory trance, you could say. And it's odd because God reveals in the vision here that things aren't going to be exactly comfortable. And you could almost say God's not exactly a great salesman. Yes, you're going to have a child, and their descendants are going to be slaves for 400 years. It's like, that's not a great way to sell the vision to Abraham. It's not exactly sweetening the pot, you could say. I don't see how that's motivating. But he has this bizarre vision that ends with this smoking fire pot, this transcendent experience, and it ends with this dreadful darkness and promise of suffering for his future family. And then the creepy smoking fire pot thing, it's bizarre. And then he's launched into his next adventure, and it does not go well. And the story of Sarah and Hagar is just so fascinating. I would love to spend a week or two on this story alone, but I'm just going to breeze through it. It's a hot mess. And I love this picture. This is Matthias Strom's painting, and I think this picture says so much. The look on their faces, the hesitancy of Hagar, the reluctance of Sarah there. Abraham just looks confused, like, is this really happening? You're okay. So the deal is this. They're old. They can't have children. So Sarah comes up with this idea. Why don't we enlist the help of my handmaid, and you can impregnate her, and then we'll have the child that God has promised to us. And so they go along with that, and it turns into a nightmare because Hagar becomes pregnant and starts gloating that she's sort of the new queen of the castle, and Sarah's very jealous. And at one point, Sarah decides to drive her off into the wilderness in her pregnancy. Get out of here, drives her out into the wilderness. An angel of the Lord has to come and rescue her, and it's like, what is going on? This is soap opera. It's so dramatic. And then it gets even more bizarre. After this fiasco, God comes to Abraham again in a transcendent experience. He appears to Abraham and reconfirms the promise. Abraham, Sarah, you will have a child. And are you prepared to make sacrifices for that promise? And you know, by this point in the story, it's like four chapters, but it's been 25 years. And it starts to feel a little cruel. Because Abraham's been making these sacrifices over 25 years, but he agrees, yes, I will make the appropriate sacrifices. I'll do whatever it takes, but this one's most bizarre. It's just so strange. Abraham, will you make the necessary sacrifices? Yes, I will. Will you do anything? Yes, I will. I want you to cut off part of your penis. Whew, didn't see that one coming. Yes, that's how the story goes. Will you make the sacrifices? Yes. And it's bizarre because it's not just his. It's like, that's not the only part. I need you to convince all the men in your tribe to do the same thing. That's a bit of a tough sell. Guys, I've had a vision. Yeah, I'm sure you have. But he does. He does it. I'll make the sacrifices. And it's like, well, what do you do with that? And it's bizarre because within a year of that, Sarah is pregnant with Isaac, and it sort of ends a certain chapter of Abraham and Sarah's life. There are more adventures to come, some bizarre ones too, but this sort of adventure series comes to a close there. And you go, what in the world do you do with these stories? You've got family tension, you've got wars, you've got time-traveling kings, animal sacrifices, dark visions, sexual triangles, and circumcision. And it's like, my goodness, how do you even make sense of what's happening here? It feels like being caught up in a jungle of details. It's like it's hard to see the forest for the trees. I'll say this, I think what makes these stories so interesting is the bizarre elements of them. That's what stories provide us. They're not interesting without bizarre details. And so there's some patterns that come to us packaged in interesting stories, and I think if you peek under the canopy, you can see these patterns. And sure, these stories, they feel over the top. I think most good stories do. They require a certain suspension of belief, but there's a pattern here to Abraham's life, and I think it looks something like this as we unpack his adventures. There's some sort of transcendent experience. God sort of communes with Abraham in some way, and then it's followed by a call to sacrifice, and then the sacrifice is followed with some sort of adventure, some sort of dramatic unfolding, which is then followed by a crossroads, a learning opportunity, and then the experience sort of repeats itself. And so I want to think about that. I want to reflect a bit on the idea of transcendent experiences and sacrifice within the faith journey, within this sort of life with God as quest motif. Transcendent experiences, encounters with God. I want to test out an idea here. I don't think I've thought it fully through, but in considering the stories of Abraham, one of the things that I'm coming to think is this. I think faith without transcendent experiences will end up withering and dying. I like this line from Richard Beck. He says this, "In the life of faith, we need to bump into God from time to time." I like that, bumping into God. I think these experiences vitalize our faith and the impetus to sort of carry on, be willing to make sacrifices. And what do you mean, Brad, by transcendent experiences? Well, I want to define that in sort of the broadest way possible, but I think to bump into God is to be, at its core, be gripped by experiences of awe or reverence or wonder. I think this is important for many of us because as I've reflected on my own faith journey, I think sometimes what can end up happening is faith can end up being reduced in at least two ways. And I think for some of us, faith can end up being simply an intellectual exercise. It's like we're engaged intellectually by faith, and it becomes sort of how can we move the chess pieces around the board to make everything fit, and it becomes a bit of an intellectual game. It becomes a faith as ideas or beliefs. I think on the flip side, faith can end up also smelling sort of like simple morality. Faith becomes primarily, it's about activism or ethics or a good morality. Jesus sort of can become for us like a moral guide. Jesus is my moral guide, my model for how to live as a human being. And all of those things I think are incredibly important. Faith is certainly no less than that. I just come to think, I don't think that's enough to sustain faith over the long haul. And I know that's been my experience. Faith as ideas or beliefs or justice or morality or ethics, it ends up, I think, becoming just exhausting after a while. It's not enough. I think we need to bump into God from time to time, which is why I think these stories showcase this pattern. People, individuals bumping into God. And I totally realize, my goodness, I got to be careful talking about this stuff because here's what ends up happening, I think. When you elevate the need for experiences, it can become sort of the goal, become an idol to itself. I think what can end up happening is the goal of faith is become experiences. The goal of Sunday morning becomes make me feel something that I will then equate with God. I think what so many churches end up doing is this, is we're going to try to manufacture experiences with God. That becomes the goal. I think that's dangerous. I really do. And I think it's worth noting that over the 25-year experience we see of Abraham here, he has, as far as I can tell, four transcendent experiences with God. That's one every, 6 years? That's not exactly a weekly experience, right? And yet I'm still inclined to think there's something there that you just can't ignore. Bumping into God is very different than following Jesus for morals or ethics or beliefs or ideas. I think we need these divine moments, divine encounters, these times when an experience sort of, it just stuns us. It interrupts us in our tracks. It just stops us dead in our tracks. We need moments. I like how William James describes this. He says, to bump into God is to feel grasped and held by a superior power. And I've come to think truly, without that, without direct personal experiences with the sacred, with the divine, with God, I think faith becomes unsustainable for many of us. And I know last week I talked a little bit about my wilderness experiences and what I've been trying to put a language and words around that, and it's become clear to me that's exactly what I've been looking for. It's this idea of wanting that experience of bumping into God to feel grasped and held by a superior power. And so when my neighbor says to me, "Are you going out there to find a burning bush?" Yes, that's exactly it. Because I don't think my faith can consist of a diet alone of intellectualism and moralism. It's exhausting. And so, yes, that's what I'm looking for. I want to bump into God. I got to check my privilege here. You got to say, hey, not all of us can hop on a plane and wander in the desert for a week. Fair enough, I agree. My point is this. I think that the moments of bumping into God are necessary. And that beyond that, I think these kind of experiences are actually far more common than we think they are if you know what you're looking for. I think most of us are awash in religious experiences if we knew how to spot them. I think moments of deep insight can be that. I mean, how could they not be? When you become enlightened by something, come to see things more clearly or gain new understanding, it's like, wow, find yourself stunned by the divine. A friend of mine told me a story about an old pastor who was retiring and he was giving away his library. And he walked in as he was sort of sorting through his books, and this old pastor was crying. And man said, what's wrong? He said, I'm giving away my books. These are my friends. They've given me so much over the years. So many insights and understanding have come from these authors, these books. It's just like, I feel like I'm parting with friends. And I sort of deeply resonate with that story because on my bookshelf alone, like how many times have I been reading or have you been reading and gone, oh my goodness, it makes sense. I have this new understanding. And I think we're so, sometimes can be so limiting in the way we conceive of divine encounters, transcendent encounters. Reading, I think, is a great way that it happens to us. I hope that here, what we do here, I hope Sundays, at least some of them, there's an insight, a kernel of something where you're like, a light bulb goes on and you go, I think I understand more. I hope that's what we're doing here. And I don't think that should be excluded from transcendent encounters. It's not just going out into the desert or wilderness. I think these experiences are everywhere for us. In fact, I would say this, and this is interesting with Chris's story. I think transcendent experiences actually happen most frequently through beauty. The beauty of art, music in particular. I think beauty is a profound channel that God uses to bump into us. I was at MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York last year, and I was so excited because Starry Night is there. And it's like my favorite painting. And I know that's not Starry Night. We'll get to that in a second. We're getting there. And I was so excited to see Starry Night. And I was like, I've always loved that painting. And I got there and I was just horrified by the experience. Because everyone's like, hey, selfie with me. And Starry Night, I'm like, what in the world are you doing? Like, what a bizarre thing to do with a painting. Me and a painting. Anyway, it's just, there was no reverence. I think that's what I was feeling, like, no reverence. It was the same with Mona Lisa, just click, 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 click. And it was bizarre, so I was like, that didn't work for me. But I remember I've always sort of kind of hated Jackson Pollock because he's always, for me, been like, anyone can do that. Like, it just looks like a mess. And I stumbled into the room in the moment that this was, and I found it empty, surprisingly, and the bench right in front of it was empty. So I thought, my goodness, I have this, and it's massive. And I sat down in the middle of the room, I had it to myself, and I just stared at it, and I can't adequately describe to you how gorgeous this piece is when it's right in front of you. It puts you in a trance. And you know, I've been thinking about that over the past year. We've talked about chaos and order through Genesis and how this painting sums that up to me. It's just chaos, and yet there's an order there, and it surprised me because I've always hated Jackson Pollock, and I love him now, and it just moved me. I sat there transfixed by it. It stunned me how gorgeous this piece was to sit in front of. You know, I've come to think this, surround yourself by beauty. And I don't mean the kind of beauty that you can intellectually, I think many of us go, yes, sure, that looks beautiful. No, like the kind of beauty that stops you in your tracks and just takes your breath away. I think God wants to bump into us in those moments. My brother went to Spain last year, and he was telling me about his experience at the, I think it's called the Sagrada Familia, or something like that. And this cathedral, this building is just fascinating to me because it's a 200-year project. Think about that. It's going to take them 200 years to build this. We can hardly get through 4 years of planning here in North America. They've somehow planned out 200 years here. This is what it looks like now. This is an interior shot. And then this is what it's going to look like when it's done. So they think they're about 70% complete now. And the amount of planning it takes to invest in something like that. My brother said he's quite indifferent about faith matters, but he said it just steals your breath walking in there. It's just glorious. He said it's like if you imagine to yourself the perfect building, this is it. The way the light plays with the structure, it's something you can only behold. It steals your breath. You know, I'm convinced of this. Beauty is a pathway towards God. It's towards a transcendent experience. And so I would say this, if you haven't bumped into God lately, you might want to find yourself more beauty in life. I've been telling this to Kristen and tell her I really want to buy an expensive painting because I think it's important to have beauty around. She hasn't quite agreed to that yet. But and it's telling to me, and she's not here. This is the weird thing because we don't value beauty, do we? Like if I said to her, and I have, I want to spend $2,000 on a painting, it's like not a chance. And it's like, that's an interesting commentary to me on the place of beauty and how we don't value it enough. Anyway, tell Kristen she should let me buy my painting. Anyway, it was bizarre to me. And you know, the other interesting thing to me is music, because it's odd. We live in, I think, one of the most cynical ages of our time, and yet people are not cynical yet about music, which I think is wonderful. We're fascinated by music. Most of us are carrying around hundreds, if not thousands, of songs in our pockets. It's for good reason. I think music is, for some people, the last element of transcendence they have in their lives. Every Saturday, I go to the library to print off my sermon. I love the library. This is a sea of humanity there that is just amazing. And there's always the same characters there every Saturday when I print off my sermon. And I've just got little names for them because I haven't met them. One is Sleepy Guy because he sits at the computers and he's always looking at maps, Google Maps, like in junk. I swear he's looking for treasure or something. And he falls asleep every week at the computer, snores, wakes himself up, keeps looking at maps, falls asleep. Anyway, I love him. He's my favorite. And then there's Music Guy. And Music Guy is there on YouTube every week on the computers with his headphones on. And when we see visions in Scripture of Abraham in this trance-like state, I go, I've seen that as well, and it's this guy. He is in a trance. And I love his abandonment. He doesn't care. He's got his headphones on, and he's just, man, he's singing out loud, and it's like the music has captured him. You know, sometimes I look at someone like that and I go, I wish I had a little bit more abandonment myself. Because he's allowed the music to just take him. And so I'm convinced of this. We need transcendent experiences. We need moments when we bump into God, because without them, I think our faith is at serious risk of withering and dying. When it's just intellectual, when it's just ethics, it's like, I don't know if that's sustainable. Jesus says in Matthew 4, you cannot live on bread alone. And I love that as sort of a metaphor for something bigger. I think it's true. We cannot live on the material alone. We need beauty. We need literature. We need music. We need encounters with the sublime. And you know, I'm not sure what that looks like for you, but I'm convinced it's important because I've seen the workings of that in my life. and how refreshing it can be. And I think we ignore them at our peril. So place yourself in a position where you might bump into God. And I don't think you can manufacture that, but I think you can make it more likely if you allow yourself, open yourself up to beauty and to the possibility of God bumping into you. And what's interesting for Abraham is he has these transcendent experiences, and it always leads directly into a call to sacrifice, which is interesting to me. Transcendent experience, call to sacrifice. And the details of these sacrifices are like foreign. Animals and circumcision, it's like, what? But I think the fundamental idea here is profound and inspiring. It boils down to this. You are not really committed to something unless you're willing to sacrifice for it. And I think this is what we see from Abraham. Constant question from God seems to be this: how committed are you to being a blessing? How committed are you to being the person I've called you to be? How committed are you to this journey? Are you committed enough to sacrifice for it? Because you aren't really committed to something unless you're willing to sacrifice. I would say even more than that, unless you are sacrificing for it. That is simply truth. And in the Abrahamic stories, the sacrifices asked of him seem just so foreign and bizarre. But I believe the pattern is true. In fact, sacrifice is the thing, I think, that separates the wheat from the chaff. It's the line between the things you romanticize or are enamored by and the things you're truly committed to. Not this past summer, the summer before, I signed up for horseback riding lessons. Everybody rides a bike or a car. I wanted to ride a horse. And I had gone horseback riding a number of times over the past year, and I thought, I want to get good at this. And so I signed up for this series of lessons. And they were 90-minute lessons. I was so excited. That was going to be my thing, the horse guy. And I remember I got out to the farm that they were at, and they said, 90-minute lesson, and it's the whole experience. I'm like, perfect. So you're going to have to clean the horse and bath the horse after. I'm like, oh, okay. Wasn't expecting that, but whatever. And so every lesson started with me having to scrape manure and stuff off of the horse's, what do you call them? See, I don't even know. Hoof, there you go. And would have to dress the horse, and then after the lesson, have to bath it after. And I didn't love it, but I loved the idea of being a horse rider. And this went on for a number of weeks, and then they informed me that we were, as an academy, we were going to be doing a Christmas show, and that I should invite all my friends to the horseback riding Christmas show. At which point I said, is there anyone else my age taking lessons with you? And they said, no, it's mostly 10 to 12-year-old boys and girls. So I thought, okay, well, this ought to be good. Me and the kids on horses, so... So then I was worried because we started rehearsing and I would ride around and hand a baton to someone else. I'm like, yeah. And it was, went around. I'm like, And then I remember, this is when everything fell apart. I don't mean to be crude here, but has anyone ever cleaned a horse? It's not easy. And so I was on the back hoof. It's like, you got to pull it off and you got to scrape off the stuff, and I remember the horse's tail just went, and just this sound. It's like, okay, it didn't poo. The stench, the horse had passed gas, like right in my face, and I'm scrubbing, and I'm like, and these images of inviting you to see me pass a baton, and I'm like, I'm done. Called him next week. I said, you know, I'm going to take some time. Maybe I'll contact you again. And I quit. And that experience taught me a very profound lesson. And it is this: I was very enamored by the idea of being a guy who rode horses. I had romanticized notions of running through the pastures on my horse and being free and whatever that meant. That's what I wanted. But when it came down to making a sacrifice and actually putting in the work, I quickly realized, nah, I'm not really committed to this. I'm in love with the idea, but I'm not really committed to it. So I gave up. I think that's the beautiful thing we see playing out in this story. Okay, it's easy to love the idea of anything, being a person of virtue and character. Whatever your goal is, it's very easy to be in love with the idea. But are you willing to make a sacrifice for it? It's like, you know, if you want to know where your true priorities lie in life, if you want to know the thing that you truly worship, the thing that is really God in your life, ask yourself this: where am I sacrificing? Because you are sacrificing. We're all sacrificing something. What does that say about what you're committed to? I'll tell you, you'll find your idols pretty quickly. And I want to actually take this moment quickly to thank you all, because there are many here in this room who are making tremendous sacrifices for Nexus, whether it's through your time, your energy, your money, your resources, shoveling out and coming through the snow, whatever it is, a lot of you have invested heavily and made sacrifices for Nexus, and I want to thank you because you're committed. And this place wouldn't run without that, and I'm grateful from the bottom of my heart that so many people say, yeah, I'm willing to make a sacrifice for this. Because that's the reality. Where you sacrifice is where your heart and priorities are. And so these stories, right, they seem primitive, they seem Hollywood. It's like, what is there even there? And I'm like, there's something really there. And it's layered and camouflaged in story. But it embodies, I think, this early in the scriptures, everything Jesus would eventually point us to. Jesus' life was an ongoing communion with God that called him deeper and deeper into sacrifice, to the point where he would give up his own life, sacrifice his own life. I think Jesus' message in many ways to us is this: come, follow me, taste of me, experience my life, experience the abundancy I want to offer you, but know it will cost you everything. I'm going to ask you to lose your life in order to find it. And Jesus calls to a sequence of death and rebirths. And that will help us as we move closer and closer to God. But why I love Abraham, why I love how this pattern is cloaked in his story, is because it reminds us it's a complete mess. The process never looks like that. It's full of learning and growing and failing and being miserable. But the pattern here is this: if you have eyes to see it, bumping into God is necessary for our faith journey, but it will call you into sacrifice. It will call you to adventure, learning, crossroads. So I want to leave you with just a series of questions. First, are you bumping into God? Have you been grasped and held by a superior power, or experienced reverence or awe or wonder lately? And again, this happened like 4 times to Abraham over 25 years, and there is definitely such a thing as a dark night of the soul, and I don't want to make this sort of the thing we chase, emotional experiences, but I think there's something there. Have you bumped into God recently? It's not something you can manufacture, but I hope that for many of us, this experience might be something that we run into. And if you're not, I would ask, why not? It could be very well a dark night of the soul, but it also might be this: that we're so busy or bitter or distracted that we're no longer receptive or awake enough to know that we have bumped into God. If you're too busy for beauty, perhaps you've bumped into God many times, but don't even know it. 2 other questions. What are you sacrificing? Because we're all doing it. We're all making sacrifices. Take inventory, because it will tell you a lot about yourself. What are you sacrificing? What does that say about you? And then perhaps this: what should I be sacrificing? What do I need to sacrifice in order to pursue the life Christ is calling me to? I'm going to leave it on that, and I wanted to blow through those chapters because I want to get through the weirdest stuff with Abraham in the next 2 weeks, the Sodom and Gomorrah story, and Isaac, the sacrifice, the call to sacrifice Isaac, right, which is highly disturbing, but I think we have the necessary framework here to start thinking about that.